Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Masonic Effects. It's, what can we do today for the next few minutes that we are together? Pretty interesting things. Can you imagine? Can you imagine being part of an organization that has that produces its own encyclopedias, its own dictionaries? Don't judge me here. I'm inclined to think that I've been around lodges where they're quite eager to give a copy of the King James writings to King James Bible to a new person, new entered apprentice. But I can't overcome this feeling that it's a novelty and a nice souvenir you puts it on the shelf. But it would be so much more meaty, so much more useful. To hand the fellow a copy of Mackay's encyclopedia with an instruction: don't trouble yourself. Put this on your shelf, and here maybe we'll give you a dictionary. And if the fellow, let's presume that we want to create a little bit of inertia, so we tell him, we'll give you this. Obviously, it's because. The way we handle language and ideas is a little different in the craft, and there's quite a bit. It's as nuanced as anybody's vocabulary. Some people are quite satisfied with a fundamental, a very basic kind of a vocabulary meets their needs and describes the experiences that they have quite adequately, and others. find that understand that language can embellish, can bring out more of experience. Well, I'm thinking, you know, and not to be too awkward about it, but when we understand we're taught, you know, classroom language, it only prepares us up to a point for what we're going to experience when we pick up literature, and when we see what Shakespeare can do with it, or Marlowe can do with it, or the writings of Dr. Johnson. You know, it just takes it up, takes us to another level in our thinking. There's nothing wrong with somebody playing the recorder, and you know, I'm just thinking back about basic or a drum, and getting that heartbeat going in with us. But it's a prelude to Beethoven, to Schumann or Schubert or Bach. You know, it's just out there. What triggers that? I don't know if it's a trigger as much as an imagination. Is it worked with the imagination? That sense, can we do this with the Ended Apprentice? You can, and Masonry would love it. You know, it quite fulfills a lot of the notions about purpose and aim of Masonry, to expand, to begin to understand. And, you know, that's a... Yes, you'd be right. It's a slippery slope, isn't it? And when we start those kind of conversations, you know, that we untrained, you know, we're just the riffraff, and there we are. We just happen to wear a white apron, but we don't know a whole lot about the Masonic way. So we don't know about rhetoric, and we've not practiced, or perhaps we've never, well, likely never not experienced it, unless you've had the, you know, more fulfilling kind of an education. But in the meantime, what happens when we try to get into these conversations? Well, you know, they do what happens in the marketplace. They just go sideways. Everybody has a strong opinion. Because they haven't had many mirrors to conscience out there. Like, mirror, listen to what you're saying. When we explain to a man here, we explain to a Mason. I'm learning here too that Masonry, that to assume that that gender goes with these ideas is really. I don't have a lot of evidence for that. I don't have a lot of evidence that these ideas are gender specific. Well, it's like mathematics is, or physics is gender specific, or science. No. This is 500 years of acceleration. So what happens when we tell a person that there's some prerequisites in a way that will, at different stages in your ambitions or your growth, will reveal other pieces of information to you? Do we actually tell them that, you know, the creators of, that the designers of, there was some really brilliant work in our ritual, but the brilliance is revealed by the study of it, that, you know, we talk about metaphor and allegory. We don't talk about steganography. These information is encrypted in front of, it's right there. If you know how to unlock the encryption, you know, the key, we like to use that word, unlock the secrets and things like that. It does take a good healthy dose of imagination, But, oh, my goodness, we begin to ask such questions. We begin to, like, we begin to think about dualism. Who thinks about that in their daily life? You know, we begin to think, we think about those pillars. There's the physical, the metaphysical, as above, so below, the Kabbalah. You know, we begin to see, we begin to understand differently. And then, oh my goodness, so if you're like me, I wrinkled my nose. Well, that can't be right. How can numerology have any effect on anybody? That's like astrology, isn't it? You know, that's just puffery. That's the way, of course, it's the prejudice I was brought up. You don't take those things seriously, do you? Well, imagination? Yeah, I do take that seriously. Well, no, that's not what I meant. I meant astrology and you know, those fanciful kinds of things. That was back when we were stupid, and we were prone to superstition, and we would look up at the sky and say, well, you know, we have the Mercury's is declining. You know, is retrograde. So, of course, that has an influence on your behavior. All as if those efforts to try and put what's happening around us and ourselves in a context is somehow wrong if it doesn't fit the scientific model. And I would think, well, there's 500 years. How is that basically about how long we've really pulled up our sleeves and sunk into science? And look what's happened. We created the internet. We've been to the moon. We have vaccines. Although the politics is what it is, but think about the science. 500 years. How long is the Earth? What are we looking at? How many billions of years of the universe? And the rarity of this human species. And although we can imagine that there's other, we want that there's other like people like us out there, and creatures like us, so that we can, because we're curious and we want to visit, but that's not probably what we're going to do. We're probably arm up and think, first thing, they're out to destroy us, so we have to kill them first. You know, come on, you know what our nature is, but there is that in these groupings or in these encampments, there's always this group of people that say, oh, no, wait a minute. Well, we don't make that assumption. We don't make that assumption at all. Imagine another 500 years where science will take us. Imagine if we get to survive that long, survive our own limitations. Right now, it is for anybody to think that this is just a, you know, fanciful. We have everything at our fingertips. Well, that's not exactly. We have some wonderful ideas, but our distribution, that's a whole other problem. The logistics on this kind of a level, how do we distribute wealth so that it meets need? And then what happens when our economics isn't driven by need? What would take the place of that? Can you imagine? And no, I'm not talking about our existing economics. I'm talking about the one where we're looking at the distribution of what people require in order to live a good life. Well, who's going to decide what the good life is? Well, of course, we'll turn to the philosophers for that. Of course. What will the politicians do with that? Well, you know, they do what politicians do. They make it self-serving and shed their sense of responsibility and make it seem like this is something that we need. Paternalism, man. But where do you get that independent rudder, you know, that sense of accountability? It comes from this whole field of ethics and morality. Let's just go back to, you know, as I started, where else are you going to find this? This kind of thinking, the classroom, but after that, where else? And to have a sense of ethic, it's, you know, we've done that. We did a good deed a few hundred years ago, you know, with that meta need. So therefore, that ought to carry through for the rest of our days. Well, we've been riding on that one for quite a while. Too often, some of us have been riding on that. And that becomes prevalent, but it also becomes defining of a way of thinking that is undeniable. It doesn't fit that this describes the totality of the experience. It doesn't describe all masonry, but it is a facet that's there. And I think it's a necessary, it's one of those necessary kind of elements that isn't in competition, but is in opposition. Just like the, you know, you think about electrons and protons, they're not happy together, but they create this, can I use the word synergy? And then they bounce, and they may be crushed into neutrons and protons, you know, release these protons and blast through us and everything. But, you know, that mass, but it happens. It happens. And for us to be thinking that or to assume that because we don't see it, that it doesn't exist. I love that kind of thinking, you know. That would mean that I should stay naive or a bit daffy my whole life, so I don't see evil. I don't see dire poverty and hunger and the degradation of the human spirit. I don't see inequality. And then I'm happy. There I am. I'm in that bliss state. Except somehow I have this need for grounding. And what in the world is that? What in the world is grounding? And what's that all about? That masonry doesn't provide. It's not going to. There's no doctrine to it. It doesn't tell us. You know, you don't have a. You know, this is the phase of life you're in. You flip to page 127, and there you'll find the answer. Well, we can. Here's the answer. Plato's Republic. Here's the answer, Hamlet, and a lived life, dealing with the fates, the unexpected happen, and wrestling with the determinism. Oh my goodness! If only the mathematics lined up and it was that simple. But even the mathematics, even Pythagoras leads us to understand that it requires some dedication, us to have a sense of value of our own progress, of our own curiosity about our own potential, about the individual potential. How could we possibly do that as a fraternal order? Well, I discovered that the lingua franca that helps us with the answer to that question is about some landmarks, understanding I've said it, therefore it is. I've said it that we are a high moral standard, therefore I am. Well, no. But nice thought. Nice thought, eh? Keen thought. But no. There's little to predict other than this sense that what we're going through as individuals tends to be commonplace, and whether a man takes his life or a person takes their life seriously or not, or is contemplative, if you said is that the case? Well, no, but I've seen people, very blunt people, very simple people. Deal with very abstract thoughts without, if you take away the fear of the terms, like, oh, abstract reasoning, you know, we can't, what in the world is that? And it is interesting intellectually, if you remember back when your mind was beginning to gain on this notion of abstraction and self-examination of your own thought and that kind of thing. It's there are different ways of understanding it that are perfectly beautiful. And they may not be my way or your way, but for the individual, they work. You know, I do suppose that that discord and pettiness and tension is part of that, maybe part of that process. But we find that in the fraternal order, we don't ought to tolerate it very well, because we're looking for something that happens when we're not distracted like that, when we're not distracted. That's, I refer to that as sort of profane, the thinking of the profane world that we bring with us when we come into lodge. We have that sense that there's something more, and there is. But masonry is like selling, in material terms in my world, I would say this is like selling you a car and you saying, fine, give me the keys. That's beautiful, beautiful machine. And I'm expecting that you're going to promise me that this will take me to beautiful places with wonderful experiences where I'll be able to have wonderful experiences. And that when I drive, it'll be just such a comfort. Well, I can't do that. World isn't like that. Where you go and what you do is around you. That's in your orbit, and we can think that we can break that down in nice little chunks that are easier to manage. I think that there are projects. We have projects. A lodge is a project. A mason is a project. Grand lodges are projects. But it's balance. It's not one way or the other, my way or the flyway. None of that. You know, you're either with this or against this. Jeez, it's balance. That those things, those elements, are always ever present. They have to be. If we take them away, things begin to wobble. You know, think of the polarities. And those forces and then the laws that we derive from that. And the beauty is when we could sit back and begin to see how all the mathematics is describing something that is in balance, that, you know, it has all this murkiness about it and things that we don't quite understand yet. But even that is part of the balance. And then, speaking of balance, here's some work that I think is exquisite. This is a writer. I can't believe this is a fellow named Horace Silver. I believe Horace is not with us anymore, but he is. Listen to what he left. Thank you. you imagine? Can you imagine what it was like around Blue Note Records when they were, you know, just amazing? There is no one way to practice speculative masonry. I think maybe I'm beating that one to death. Eh? Neither can it be said we are a chaotic lot. Although, you know, the Scottish Rite would tell us, or order out of chaos. Neither can it be said we are chaotic. Instilling a sense of purpose happens, I think, when we are with the entered apprentice who asks questions of himself, at least in balance with the questions he asks of the order. If he doesn't ask, you don't find. How direct we are isn't as important as whether we are sensitive to how vulnerable we all were being overwhelmed by the depth and intensity of our body of work. Were we overwhelmed? Helping him adjust to this is like teaching somebody about the vastness of mathematics or organic chemistry or law or justice. That too can excite the imagination or be a daunting sensation we need to overcome. How do we teach our entered apprentice to own his effort, to respect progress, and to explore the possibility he may have found a way to unlock potential? It isn't mechanical. It isn't doctrine. If you're a fan of ideas written in metaphor, then you will be happy you've been given an apron and tools of identification. Some will find it off-putting that steganography was put to use throughout our ritual practice, as if deciphering metaphor and allegory wasn't enough. Messages were embedded, concealed information that the unsuspecting would not think to consider. This, too, is part of learning the symbolic language of a Mason. If it is you we are speaking to, have you found contentment? Are you thinking your effort is done, or are you inspired by your findings? No. Isn't it diabolical? You can know masonry in that way, but be unable to convey that directly to others. We cannot eat another man's meal, in other words. Much as we might want to try. But what we can do is, and what we do without anything artificial about it, it's not the standard test within the bureaucracy. You pass the test, you can be a horrible person. You pass the test and therefore you reach this, you check off the box for the next pay grid. And it's none of that. This is about, as we begin to read them and study them, as we begin to think about to come up with a question and then to think that what we've stumbled into is a source of answers, and that what will distinguish us is ability, is merit, that's intelligence and effort, action, and all that those, tedious little things about self-discipline, and becoming enthusiastic about it. And thinking, well, I've been taught that boys are only interested in something physical or something athletical. Well, really? Really? Not quite. There's not quite enough evidence in the universe to support that one. But go ahead and think it, If it works for you, it's just a supposition, So just to think, that engagement, we don't enforce the engagement. No. If you happen to stumble into an area that's unfamiliar to you and you happen to sink your teeth and you find that, and I like to use the term have natural ability with it, and it doesn't fit with the pattern, and you're arguing with mummy and daddy that you don't want to be a dentist, that you actually want to be a philosopher, or you actually want to be, you need to be a musician. Oh my goodness, scandalous. maybe our it's talking to our child, and his name is Luciano, and Luciano comes to us, and we hear him, you know, humming the songs that mummy sings when she's busy about the house and coming back from work. And that, my goodness, for a little boy, it seems, it's such a nice voice. And we have him singing around worship, and then he sings in public, and he seems to like it. He's nervous, but he seems to like it, and it's because he's listening to this voice, and it's kind of, you know, it's kind of special. We don't have a lot, but do you think we ought to scrape it together and find him a good teacher? Like others in the village are saying, you know, there's very, very talented, you know. But we always wanted him to be a dentist. And then he became Pavarotti. Am I disappointed? Should I be disappointed with the boy? And how long has he been gone? Been gone, what, 5 years? Will we ever, ever, ever stop talking about that voice? Like, you know, even if you close your eyes, it's right there. It's right there. And this is coming from a boy that the furthest thing from my experience when I was a boy would have been to appreciate and love the voice of Pavarotti. But there you have it. There you have it. It's like, why? Well, maybe I can sit down and figure out why, but just enjoy it in the meantime. How many of you have those own little caveats in your existence? And that is just pure, pure bliss for the likes of me, that you bring that exchange into our lodge. And I learn from your, you know, your researches, the way you think, and the idiosyncrasies that enliven you, and to see, to experience that moment when you're inspired. You know, it's chemical, isn't it? The reaction when you see somebody that's inspired, just tremendously. It's just beautiful. So it goes. And if we look over our shoulder, there has always been within this vast universe of masonry, and all these fellows who think, well, you know, that was a bit of a dodgy situation, or that lodge, there was no sustainability with that, which, you know, without some kind of ethical core, there's not much to sustain the progress of masonry. But that's me. Maybe you could say, well, politics will do it. You know, we want to join because maybe we'll rub shoulders and make money. Well, no, that doesn't work either. The collision is that we see these moments of inspiration, and it feeds us. Now, are we defining? Well, nobody really defines that. We can, but find the parallels. Is it I meet too many fellows where I am that just think that it's a great, great, great club. It's a great, great hobby. It's a distraction. Mm. I've stopped feeling sorry for those guys anymore. It's like, move on. And that's what I'm going to do here. I'm going to move on. This is Herbie Hancock. For those who, yeah. Is he older than, I think he's been around forever. Enjoy this. Thank you. It's like finding a mood, isn't it? Yeah, it's like, I think, tell me, is jazz more about our emotional inclination? It's soothing. It's just soothing. Yeah. This week we're taking advantage of another poet to teach us things about the world around us that we tend to, we may be walking past every day, you know, those little things. Think Wilt Thou, I think about my favorite poem, the Daffodil, Think Wilt Thou Let It Slip Useless Away. Here, John Skelton, our poet this week is John Skelton. Now, to be honest with you, I don't have a copy of his work sitting on my desk. And I've met people that probably do. John Skelton was born circa 1463 to 1529. Yep. He became a tutor to the future King Henry VIII. Yeah, that guy. And then he took holy orders and he became the rector of Diss in Norfolk until his death. Taking holy orders meant that along with the pensions that came by being tutored to the future king would guarantee him a certain quality of life, an income. And he stands, and the scholars tell us that he stands amongst the most engaging and original of the early modern poets. Now, I know about, I have this rough sense of modernism, and I have a rough sense of some of the different forms of poetry, just like you. But to think about that period as early modern poets, is really describing, it's beginning to describe something that's evolving culturally. In here, in this collection of dialogues and lyrics, are the tribute to Margaret Hussey, and it first appeared and was described by Skelton as a right delectable treatise upon a goodly garland or caplet of laurel. He was devised by Master Skelton, poet laureate. The garland of laurel, or as it's more succinctly known, is a dream vision. And you can even check this out if you're inclined. I suggest using a glass of a Merlot, you know, if you're going to do that. Oh, yeah. Or no, maybe even a nice brandy. Although my friend John would say, well, you know, he won't turn down a good brandy, but you know, my serving him an Italian brandy, he tends to like the French. All right, so we'll disagree, but. You know, see what I'm thinking. You know, what relaxes? What do you love? Skelton is added by various allegorical figures, such as occupation and fame, midlife reassessment. Poeta Skelton gives us a sufficiently good account of himself to be awarded an impressive laurel wreath, working with silver and gold and pearls, by the Countess of Surrey and her court ladies. The garland concludes with a poem dedicated to each of the ladies in order of rank. Skelton's frequently you know, do we want to get into Demeter and Trimeter? Okay. I won't. You could do that if you need, you know. It's like this giving you a pencil and then stopping to describe what the eraser on the end does for you. Skelton's, we want to know, is he suggesting that she might be a predator or at least somebody who can deliver a sharp verbal rebuke from a lofty height? You know, does she have a sharp tongue? Margaret Hussey is clearly not a threat, not a woman of extremes. Perhaps, though, there's a suggestion that she has been tamed. This is language that's just going to fit so well with their contemporary environment. No. When I do this, do we judge according to that period, Tudor, what are we looking at, 16th century, do we judge that with our values or with the values prevalent in the day? I'd say both, because both are reality. And in this, we suspend our disbelief and take his word for it that Margaret Hussey fully deserved her eulogy that he's giving her. Yep. He had a reputation. He was educated at the University of Cambridge, you know, fortunately. And he achieved the status of poet laureate, a degree in rhetoric. A degree in rhetoric at Oxford, and in Leuven in the Netherlands, and at Cambridge. That's saying to us that he, listening to him, he was persuasive. He translated Greek and Roman authors, and that got attention of some influential people, and it led to his appointment in 1488, first as court poet to Henry VII, and later, in addition, as schoolmaster to the Duke of York, later Henry VIII. So in 1489, we find Skelton took the orders in 1502, and he became heir. When Henry became heir to the throne and the royal household was reorganized, he became rector at Dies. And in 1512, Henry VIII granted him the title of Order Regius, Speaker of the. And in his capacity, he became a forthright advisor to the king in court poems, in public issues, and on church affairs. And we all know how that worked out for us. So we won't get into if you're a student of the Renaissance, which one you would ask, well, or the Enlightenment, you know, which one would you ask? This is a good jumping off point to Mistress Hussey. Beautiful piece of work. And as you listen, tell me what you get from this. And I'll try and do it justice, please. My apologies to Skelton and to you. Mary Margaret, Mary, M-E-R-R-Y, Mary Margaret, as midsummer flower, gentle as a falcon or hawk of the tower. With solace and gladness, much mirth and no madness, all good and no badness, so joyously, so maidenly, so womanly, her demeaning in everything far, far passing that I can indite or suffice to write of Mary Margaret. As midsummer flower, gentle as a falcon or hawk of the tower. As patient and still, as full of goodwill, as fair as a fill, coriander, sweet pomander, good Cassander, steadfast of thought, well made, well wrought, far may be sought ere that ye can find so courteous, so kind as Mary Margaret. This summer flower, gentle as falcon or hawk of the tower. Thank you. Nothing like a little Paul Desmond sax to round out the show. Speaking of rounding things out, you still with me? Yeah. History. What can we learn? Well, history teaches us about us. It helps to define us to us. And without it, imagine, yeah, we have history to live in the moment. We begin to understand past and future, the context of living in the moment. Are we gentle about our history, or are we? Do we put on these glasses through these lenses that look for the bitterness and the anger and the pettiness? Because if that's the case, it's always there. It's always in anything. if you hand me something and say, man, this is flawless, but what I want you to do is find the flaw. Well, why is it that I have the ability to find the flaw in something beautiful? And if I turn that upside down, can I find the beauty in chaos? Can I find something redeeming in tension? Well, I like to think I just draw a line on that thinking. I like to think that speculative Freemasonry has done that for me. So it's opened up that path of thinking. That, you know, so long ago, dealing with people that were, you know, attempting to control a conversation or by either volume or, you know, trying to intimidate, you know, doesn't work. Works for some, but doesn't work, you know. You learn that the person is trying to express something and they don't have, and they're using a chainsaw instead of a scalpel. Ouch. Here's an example. It just happens to be in front of me. And this is about some of the things we found historically. And we're still visiting The Hague, aren't we? And we're still talking about the influence of British masonry. And we know that The Hague was in there. People were visiting it from all over Europe, all over the world. Where because you could find an exchange of ideas. And oh my goodness, with that exchange of ideas, it does mean that there is, compared to rigidity, it tends to, we've injected this word liberalism, and I don't know, that's so laden with politics these days, and I think sometimes it's lost its true meaning, you know, the impact. This is just gives us something more than assumptions to draw on. Here we're looking at, we've just talked about a lodge, first known lodge for women and men anywhere in Europe. Yes. And again, this speaks to the idea that there's little about philosophy that's gender-based, little about mathematics that's gender or science in general, until we bring that up and justify it, which is, I think, finding the flaw in the beauty. Whoa, does this get into theology? Won't even go there. Won't even go there. No. Just top up my drink while you're up, topping up your own. This is about l'éloge du juste, l'éloge of justice, unique. So this is a lodge that began to work with the idea of men and women in the lodge. From manuscript, the manuscript records of du juste have the lodge's constitution along with a complete membership list. And they also provide a set of initiation rituals. The rituals are the records are entirely in French and the spoken language of polite society in mid-18th century Holland. And perhaps appropriately, Le Juste invented its own rituals so that the female and male members may express their equality, fraternity, and mutual search for virtue and wisdom. Each initiation ceremony for admission or for the various Masonic degrees brought the initiate closer to this virtue, which, as shown by one ritual, is equated with productivity and the discipline of industry. In other words, action. You bring the imagination, you be influenced, but acting on it is important for that, for us to find that contentment, find the value. Almost without exception, the language of the ritual is highly mystical and symbolic. Squares, temples, symbolic fires, and secret words abound in the original texts. Some of this language derived from the alchemical tradition. All of it was intensely spiritual. Most important, it is new language, not commonly found in other Masonic texts from the same period. This signed signal characteristic might best be described as a mystical striving, the search for perfect virtue. Generally, we would not expect to find this kind of language in Masonic circles so early in the century. By the 1770s, particularly in Germany, Masonry had rediscovered the mystical, the magical, the Rosicrucian, and the alchemical, grafting with tradition and onto its rituals and its ethos. Similarly, it begins to appear in records of Amsterdam lodges, also around the 1770s, possibly imported from their many ties with Germany and its cultural movements. The use of the mystical and magical to express Masonic ideals might be imagined as always present in the movement, the legacy of its links to Renaissance humanism and Hermeticism. Yet both the British and continental records of 18th century Freemasonry present a more complex picture. In the early part of the century, the mystical and magical elements in the Masonic legacy of the 17th century seem barely evident. Even the pantheism of Rousseau has a rationalist quality about it, with no excursions into the mystical as a way of expressing belief in nature as distinct from belief in the Judeo-Christian God. This rationalist tone fits well enough with the early universal repudiation of religious enthusiasm so characteristic of the early Enlightenment. Imagine that. Imagine that, hey? Well, thank you for tuning in today. It's been interesting. I hope you've, of course, found the show to be of some use, either reinforcing your thinking or creating, you know, it is a discussion point. So, and I hope we would be able to have these discussions later on whenever we have a chance to meet. Or two of you and a couple of your mates, if you can just have at it, just enjoy. It's been a pleasure. Trying to be informative and educational and entertaining, that's a pleasure. I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, that's terrible. It isn't. It's wonderful. And the response is, thank you. That's all that I care to say. I'm grateful. I look forward to being with you again soon. Masonry, if you don't mind, I just step back for a second and look at what's going on around us. If we get aggressive and try and, you know, create billboards all over the place and say, this is the way you ought to think, we're just joining the cacophony, because there's a lot of people out there telling the world, this is the way you ought to think. Instead, we are the influence. And I see it, I see it in the fellow that is has taken up marathon running. You know, that's a meditation. And I have friends that have practiced transcendental meditation for most of their adult life, since they began to understand it and learn it. There is an influence, and we could, any cynic will say, oh, well, you're not making much of a difference. The cynic would say that, wouldn't they? Yes, we are. Yes, we are. And especially with social media, we are we're not the fly in the ointment. We're the light shining through the crack. The despotism and isolation and meanness is cracking because of this silly, ridiculous accountability. We know people anywhere are beginning to hook up to the internet, and they're telling stories, and we're witnessing the stories. And, you know, we scratch our heads and we find, my goodness, we have so much in common. We have so much in common. So if you want to, human traffickers, you're having a harder time of it. And yeah, we will, and we really relish hunting that bunch. You know, that's some of the most complex adversaries out there. And boy, we've got some incredible hunters out there looking for them. And there's some beautiful things happening. And I wanted to say, it is, as painful as it is, the struggle for equality by women that is going on right now is breathtaking. I do what I can in my way, and I would encourage anybody listening to consider their plight and certainly the advantage of finding the equality that you and I experience as Masons with these beautiful ideas. They want the choice, and we are big enough to create opportunity and respect it and defend it. I always defend it. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. If I'm going to give you any expletive, it's, you know, think about it. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Include yourself. Include yourself. The world is what it is, and it's a better place because you're in it. I look forward to being with you again. Bye for now.